You are listening to the Star Lores Podcast.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Are you stuck up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder?
But I was going into Toshi Station to pick up some power converters.
With over 25,000 years of computer records alone, the idea that anything, artifacts, cities, weapons, has been lost is absurd. In my experience, if something can't be found, it's because someone wanted it that way.
Dr. Henrietta Antilles, Xenoarchaeology Defined, New Journal of Ancient Studies. Archaeology is the study of the physical evidence that a culture produces. This evidence is termed material culture. It is usually grouped together with cultural anthropology as an academic discipline, with many archaeologists working in the anthropology department of their universities. Because it analyzes physical evidence, archaeology is sometimes seen as being closer to a hard science than its intellectual cousins, sociology, history, and cultural anthropology. It is an interdisciplinary science that draws on the fields of biology, physics, and chemistry, to name a few. Archaeology also has an experimental branch, wherein researchers attempt to reconstruct artifacts using techniques available to the original creators of the material culture. Additionally, advanced techniques utilizing everything from satellite-mounted sensors, microscopy, and medical imaging are commonly used in archaeological investigations. Xenoarchaeology is simply taking the study of material culture beyond a single planet and sentient species. In the galactic context, it draws heavily from xenosociology. For the most part, xenoarchaeology concerns cultures within the galactic community. These cultures are usually quite technologically advanced, although there are many case studies in xenoarchaeology that concern a single pre-space culture, such as the now extinct Ilean group, who once lived in the caverns of Polis Massa. However, it is the more ancient and mysterious subjects of xenoarchaeology which shed a light on the development of the galactic community. A useful point of reference is the formation of the Old Republic, circa 25,000 BBY. Anything prior to this date can be considered as a kind of galactic prehistory, and is historically referred to as the Early Hyperspace Age. This period lasts essentially from 13 billion years BBY to 25,053 BBY. In that year, the formation of the Republic then marks the beginning of the modern hyperspace age. It is cultures that flourished and then died out completely or declined during this period that will be focused on here. History itself starts in most cultures with the invention of writing. Writing represents a quantum leap forward in communication between individuals and the society, and eventually between societies as well. For the galaxy, the formation of the Old Republic represented a quantum leap forward in communication, as the technologies of hyperspace travel and long-range communication had recently matured. Like writing had facilitated massive changes in societies, so too did the Old Republic. The New Republic Historic Council may consider the early hyperspace era, quote, notoriously difficult to research, but a plethora of material culture or records of material culture from the era have survived the indifference of time.
Context 4. Columi. Circa 2 million to 0 BBY.
The Columi Mental Hover Pod was a technological wonder. Equipped with a nuclear fission-driven power generator, the pod could reach top speeds of 120 kilometers an hour and was controlled via an onboard brainwave sensor. The Columi species used these assistive devices to get around as natural selection had for the countless generations selected against their limbs being strong enough to carry their enormous craniums. The flip side of the selection pressure against ambulating limbs in Columi is their ever-increasing encephalization quotient. This measurement is the ratio of brain mass to body mass, and on this measure of most sentient species, rate higher than their non-sentient counterparts. The trend is taken to an extreme in the Columi, with half or more of their body mass being taken up by their brain. Since they can use this hyperspace specialized organ to solve most problems other beings require robust bodies to solve, their limbs have atrophied to the point of being considered vestigial. On their homeworld of Columus, an evolutionary ancestor of the Reptosapien Columi transitioned from an amphibious niche in a swampy wetland to an arboreal niche in the trees. This conferred two important adaptations. Offspring were much better protected in the trees, and the ancestral Columi could survive off of nutrient-rich fruits found in the trees. These ancestors then developed tool use, which immediately began a long process of evolutionary fusion with their technology. Further biological adaptations were driven by their tool innovations, and they soon lost their prehensile tails and became facultative bipeds. It wasn't long in evolutionary timescales before the Columi were extracting resources from Columus's crust and building cities. By 2 million BBY, they embarked on their first interstellar explorations. Being a naturally curious and intelligent species, these first journeys were scientific in nature. The Columi were hoping to find brethren in the stars. Instead, they found what they considered to be subsentients and barbarians on the homeworlds of many of the longtime member species of the galactic community. After an initial period of exploration, Columi civilization has remained largely isolated since about 100,000 BBY. Obo Rin, an imperial researcher, claimed that the Galactic Empire made first contact with the Columi, although this claim is disputed. Columus did remain a nominal member of the galactic community after their exploratory period. Their technological innovations kept pace with the wider galaxy, although they were too specialized to be useful for most species. Between 25100 BBY and 10,000 BBY, a hyperspace beacon named Belgoth's Beacon was deployed as part of the original network that supported early use of the Perlemian trade route. A Columi face, along with the two other species, was molded onto the exterior of the satellite, perhaps as a nod to Columi participation in early hyperspace travel. Such beacons were integral for safe hyperspace travel before the advent of sophisticated navicomputers. In addition to requiring hover pods to travel, the Columi also needed cloning technology in order to reproduce. At least some clone troopers were likely produced on Columus during the Clone Wars. Civilian use of the facilities was heavily regulated at the time. Columi engineers built the famous GH7 medical analysis unit for Chioweb Amalgamated Pharmaceuticals Company. GH7s were notable for being programmed with multiple medical subspecialties, a self-contained repulsor unit, and three agile arms. They were also designed with the user experience in mind, as their designers took great care in its aesthetics so that most species would feel comfortable receiving treatment from it. When the Galactic Empire rose to power, the Columi were quick to lend their support. In exchange, Columus was largely left to govern itself during the Imperial period.
Context 3. The most ancient and forgotten days, circa 1 million BBY to 4 ABY.
Basic rule of xenoarchaeology. You don't unleash a foreign technology into a population center, especially one with a man-machine interface.
Captain Gola.
Rokakik was a master of Gree technology in the years prior to the Clone Wars. Like all Gree, he was about 1 meter tall, with a large head and 6 tentacular arms. He had grayish skin, large black eyes, and a voluminous head. When he served as captain of a massive starship called the Rokak Baron, his culture was in decline compared to all that it had been in generations past. By the late Republic era, the Baron was the only extant example of such a ship that was still operational. And Rokakik was the only being who could operate it. With his specialized tentacles, he even personally operated many of the ship's more advanced systems. The Baron carried an exotic armament, producing huge whip-like projections of force field energy to slash enemy ships with, rather than conventional weapons, like lasers and blasters. The venerable captain felt a strong sense of duty towards operating the ship. It was responsible for the transportation of most goods and beings throughout the Gree Enclave, a handful of star systems in a region of space in the Outer Rim. Though humble relative to other star-spanning civilizations like the Republic or the Galactic Empire, it once played a far more crucial role in shaping history. It still stands as one of the most technically proficient cultures known, after hundreds of thousands of years of exploring the hazardous galaxy. The Gree are still here. The Gree were one of the first 4 pioneers of hyperspace technology. The other 3 were the Kwa, the Celestials, and the Colomai. They left massive features in the form of hypergates. These architectural wonders occupied a sacred space in some later permutations of Gree society. These structures were large metallic rings. A small freighter could probably fly through one. When active, a suspended blue energy field filled the space inside the ring. At some distant location in the galaxy, a similar ring would activate. A being could, in principle, walk through a hypergate at Tython in the deep core and emerge on Assation in the Outer Rim a moment later. The Gree refer to this travel, quote, from one sphere to another, end quote. The hyperspace wormholes that were used in hypergate travel were likely unstable. The hypergate junction was a one-way path only. One would have to travel to a third world in order to circle back around to the hypergate of origin. At various points in galactic history, hypergates have been the source, or perhaps linchpin, in violent skirmishes or all-out wars. The technological principles behind hypergates could also be deployed as a weapon of mass destruction. Early on in the Gree exploration of the galaxy, they developed an ethical code surrounding the sharing of their amazing technology with other species. They would only share technology with non-Gree if the other species could, in theory, develop the same technology. Gree may have reached the stars earlier than their contemporaries, the Celestials, Colomai, Sharu, and Kwa. By 100,000 BBY, however, these and several other species had made it to space and were developing their own hyperspace technology.
At an undated time, a group of Gree began worshipping Abeloth, called by the Killiks, quote, the bringer of chaos. There are Killik paintings from the period documenting the Gree sacrificing their enemies to the bringer of chaos. Another impressive Gree starship was the Grey Sekhmet. This advanced ship appears to have been automated, programmed to explore the galaxy and record various scientific data. It was crewed by a large complement of automated droids. The vessel did not conform to traditional starship design conventions, perhaps owing to its scientific mission, the synthetic crew. In the center of the four large sections of the hull was a large ring. Inside that ring was an orb of red energy, inside of which was a sphere of metallic panels. The technology on board of the Sekhmet was so different than anything else in the galaxy that it was invisible to most sensors. This could indicate that it somehow managed to do all that it did while producing no, or perhaps masking, its electromagnetic emissions. It was seen at various far-flung locations in the galaxy throughout history. The true nature and purpose of the Grey Sekhmet is obscure, although some researchers have spent extensive time on board the ship. Over the millennia, much of Gree civilization had sunk into the mists of time and became mythological, even to themselves. Their long history of technical innovation reduced to little more than museum curation, as many Gree devoted themselves to maintaining the glorious technology of their past, or else attempted to reverse engineer it. Like many of the ancient species, the Gree were once a client race to the Celestials. After this star empire collapsed, the Gree largely retreated from history.
And now, a word from our sponsors.
We're Chiwab Nutrition. We make advanced food from complicated ingredients you can't pronounce. We only spawn premium vat-cultured meat analogs with just the right amount of Andris. We never clutter up our packaging with boring lists of ingredients, nutritional information, or health warnings so that your photoreceptors can feast on our aesthetically optimized nutritional units. We use only artificial preservatives, only artificial flavors, only artificial colors, only artificial sweeteners, and only cloned animal cells. Chiwab Nutrition. Optimized nutrition for optimized beings.
Context 2. The Architects. Circa 1 million BBY to 19 BBY.
We are sorry. We do not know how to explain the Celestials any better. They are beyond the understanding of mortals.
The Root. The galactic community is in large part an evolution of one particular culture. These celestial beings were in effect the architects of the galaxy we know today, although their influence on the galactic community has waned considerably. There are few cultures with comparable artifacts as old or massive as those left behind by the enigmatic species. Dr. Insmot Boehm even posited that the entire universe could have been built by Celestials, although he presented no serious evidence in support of the idea. The legendary Celestialist was also an expert on Ophidian grotesques, a style of sculpture common to the most ancient parts of Coruscant and elsewhere. Much of the current understanding of Celestials stems from Dr. Bowen's work. In terrestrial archaeology, when a site is excavated, feature is the term used to refer to the non-portable or permanent aspect of the site. For example, a plowed field or the foundation of a building. The Celestials left far greater testaments to their grandeur behind. Centerpoint Station in the Corellian system was one such feature. It maintained a position at the Lagrange point of L1 between the twin planets Talus and Tralis in the third orbital position. The easiest reference point in size of Centerpoint Station is the DS1 orbital battle station, although it was dwarfed by Centerpoint. It has consistently been the subject of immense scholarly investigation, although its untimely demise during the Second Galactic Civil War presumably torpedoed many forthcoming academic articles. Before this, however, researchers discovered that it was capable of generating a hyperspace tractor beam. When activated, the beam could move stars through hyperspace, and was even capable of collapsing them. Considering this, a reasonable model for the formation of the otherwise chemically and orbitally anomalous Corellian system has been proposed. Put simply, the Celestials did it. It is also believed that the Drawl and Salonians were settled in the Corellian system by the Celestials. Engineers eventually learned how to operate Centerpoint Station, and it was used to trigger at least one supernova, as well as being used as a weapon on one occasion during the Yuuzhan Vong War. In 44 ABY, Jedi historians learned that it was built by the Thurut Kilikive, at the direction of the Celestials. The Maw Cluster, the black heart of the Maw Nebula, is also a Celestial feature, according to one Jedi Grandmaster. It was created sometime between 1 million BBY and 25,000 BBY. The singularity at the center of each of the black holes are surrounded by deep blue maelstroms of ionizing gas. Navigating anywhere near the Maw is dangerous. The space near any black hole is hazardous due to the crushing gravity and deadly radiation. This is only magnified in the Maw with so many black holes in close proximity. The unimaginable mass of the cluster mangles space-time, and all but the most cocksure pilots risk flying near the cluster. Within the Maw is a construction that resembles Centerpoint Station in many respects, although it is much smaller, called Sinkhole Station. This construct, perhaps in conjunction with Centerpoint Station, may have moved the black holes from their original locations, or else collapsed the stars that preceded them. It is all but certain that two individual Celestials, possibly enlisting the Thurut Kilikive for labor, built the Maw and other artifacts and sites nested within the feature. The black holes of the Maw were, in essence, the walls of a prison built to incarcerate the dark side being, Abeloth. The space-time disturbances created by the Maw cluster made traveling to the world she was imprisoned on nearly impossible. On Abeloth's prison world, there are examples of Ophidian grotesque statuary, indicating cultural continuity between this world and an ancient Coruscant. Also in the Maw cluster is the spice mining world of Kessel. Deep within the planet's vast tunnel networks are a plethora of ancient devices and constructions of an uncertain cultural origin, although some believe that these too are celestial. That is to say, nothing of the ruins that dot the now inhospitable surface, or of the skeletal remains of an unidentified avian species.
Celestial material culture throughout the galaxy.
Out of the great void came the universe, its galaxies, star systems, and suns. Everything that exists and will ever exist was spawned from the primordial plasma of time's beginning.
The Holocron of Ud-Banar.
A similar astro artifact can be found in the void of Eogros. This region in wild space is notable for being a stellar desert. Although space is at best only partly stars, in the void of Eogros, this is particularly true. The Quintarid, a solar system consisting of 5 stars, are the only stellar objects in the region. Astrophysicists have concluded that the Quintarid was engineered, although quaternary star systems are known to occur naturally. The fact that no probes ever sent to the Quintarid ever successfully collected much data before going offline may have informed the artificial origin conclusion. Elsewhere in the decentralized corner of the galaxy is the Aeonian Ring, which orbits the planet ENN3. A similar construct also orbited the star Diashian, and was called the Diashian Clockwork. The Aeonian Ring is no belt of captured ice crystals and meteorites, such as might be found in orbitals above other worlds, but is thought to have been built by the Celestials. The ash-blackened ring contrasts vividly against the brilliantly white, sand-covered surface of the planet below. The damage visible on the ring may be indicative of the war that led to the destruction of the Celestial civilization. This is similar to what in terrestrial archaeology is termed a destruction layer, which can be found at many ancient sites. Many destruction layers are, like the Aeonian Ring, indicated by a layer of ash, often mark the end of one distinct cultural group's occupation of a site and herald the beginning of another. The improbably named Krilithium system was also host to a celestial site. A diamond-shaped monolith that looks like 2 pyramids attached at the base orbited the star. Although the monolith is large, at 5,000 meters from point to point, it is nowhere near the size of most planets. However, it does have a docking base which will open and allow ships to fly into it. Inside, the only thing visible is blinding light. The inhabitants of the ship will then find themselves in a planetary atmosphere. The name given to the location in a historic record is usually something close to, quote, the planet Mortis, unquote, or, quote, the realm of Mortis, to distinguish it from the Mortis monolith. It is thought that the monolith is kind of a stargate to a world in some distant location, presumably outside the Krilithium system. In the realm of Mortis, there are a number of sites attributable to the Celestials. These places are relatively simple, technologically speaking. There are no visible power plants, factories, or industry of any kind. Electricity may not even be present. The Altar of Mortis is a site that has an impact on relatively recent galactic history. It is where the Celestial known as the Sun committed filicide, and so the Jedi say, unbalanced the Force. The murder weapon, called uncreatively the Dagger of Mortis, was sought by Jedi archaeologists as recently as 44 ABY. The Ophidian tradition of sculpture is also present in the Outer Rim, on Shatun. In the Inner Rim, a cloud of metallic alloy and rocky material orbits the star Penelagilin. Much of the metal displays evidence of explosions in the form of scorched alloy, while many of the other debris appears to have been flash frozen. The Penegilin shards, too, are thought to have once been a celestial construct, in their pre-shard form. A currently dead world called Callus Tertius in the Inner Rim also contains celestial artifacts in the form of Ophidian grotesques.
Context 1. Jedi archaeology. 36,453 BBY to 44 ABY.
I hate to say it, but it looks like the system you're searching for doesn't exist.
Impossible. Perhaps the archives are incomplete.
If an item does not appear in our records, it does not exist.
Archaeology has been interwoven with the monastic Jedi Order since its very inception. In a certain sense, those first pilgrims from every corner of the galaxy were conducting a kind of ad hoc xeno-archaeological excavation when they stepped aboard the Tho'Yor spacecraft. On Manan, the Sel'Kath even treated the Tho'Yor that slumbered at the bottom of their ocean as an archaeological site, long before the pyramid opened up and let them aboard. The ships themselves were already ancient by the time of the pilgrimage. The Celestials were ascendant until roughly the time of the pilgrims' arrival on Tython. The design of the Tho'Yor are reminiscent of the Mortis monolith, sharing the same basic double pyramid shape. Once on Tython, the pilgrims discovered the material culture of a long extinct society, the Old City, included a huge stepped pyramid, ancient by the time the Jedi occupied Tython. Long before the pilgrims arrived on Tython, the Gree briefly colonized the planet. They settled in the ruins of the Old City, which were already long abandoned. The Kwa also visited for a time and constructed their own teleportation technology, Infinity Gates, on the world. In the first two millennia of Tython's colonization, the Jedi culture spread to nearby worlds in the solar system. One of its moons, Bogan, was settled. It was soon abandoned in favor of more inviting locations within the Tython system. The large stone structures these early settlers left behind were later occupied as a kind of penal colony for the internment of Jedi exiles. When the Jedi Order formed, they retained the by now time-honored tradition of archaeology from their spiritual predecessors. Naturally, the first capital world of the Order, Ossus, would in itself become an archaeological site studied by the Jedi in the distant future. Most Jedi archaeologists were consulars, since adherents were largely concerned with scholarly pursuits. Jedi archaeologists reported their research to the educational corps. One of the most famous Jedi archaeologists was Jocasta Nu. Eventually, she was promoted to the position of head librarian of the Jedi Temple's archives. She was killed during Operation Nightfall, but managed to have the contents of the archives copied onto data chips. Her apprentice, Race, escaped with the priceless data. In archaeology, there are many distinct skill sets. Some researchers know their pottery sherds. Others are great with coprolites. Taphonomy is the study of an organism's decay and deposition into the archaeological record. In this sense, there's rather direct taphonomical data about Jocasta Nu. After Darth Vader impaled her in the chest with his lightsaber, her body laid on the floor for several hours as more Jedi and their child apprentices were systematically hunted by Vader and his clone troopers. In the aftermath, her body was visited by fellow clerics from the Jedi Council. It is thought that after authorities confirmed the identity of Nu's corpse, it was moved to a funeral pyre at the entrance to the Jedi Temple. Exar Kun first became corrupted by the dark side while conducting archaeological investigations. he sought Sith artifacts for the power they could bestow upon him. Some objects that the Dark Lord once owned became artifacts millennia after his death, themselves bestowing sinister powers on their owners. One of these impressive artifacts was a Sith holocron. From it, Kun is believed to have learned the secrets of crafting a double-bladed lightsaber. In his era, circa 4000 BBY, he is often credited with inventing the weapon. Sith have for generations after Kun favored the double-bladed lightsaber, or saber staff, so much so that the weapon would become known by many as the Sith Saber. It is thought that Kun's holocron was written by the Dark Lords who reigned during the Hundred Year Darkness. If this is the case, then the appearance of the first double-bladed lightsaber may be dated to 7000 BBY. Revan's Sith Empire was obsessed with xenoarchaeology. An ancient material culture was the source of their harrowing war machine. Revan and Malak carried out an expedition that led them to the Starforge, a battle station, shipyard, and munitions depot of Rakatan origin. With this artifact, they nearly destroyed the Galactic Republic. In the process of discovering the Starforge, they visited archaeological sites on Dantooine, Tatooine, Kashyyyk, Manan, and Korriban. Korriban, in particular, was site-rich. The Valley of the Dark Lords was heavily excavated during the Jedi Civil War by students and faculty of the Sith Academy. Sith Lords have always fetishized their religion's past. Many of them collected items that have been infused with the dark side in some way that lends itself to weaponization. During the Mandalorian Wars, a secret cabal of Jedi archaeologists was dispatched to collect and destroy various Sith artifacts in order to prevent them from being used as weapons again.
Thanks for flying with us. Jordan here. Just wanted to let everyone know what's happening here at the Star Lores podcast. Star Lores is now on Discord. If you would like to join the Star Lores Cantina Discord server, you can find a link in the description or on any of our social media accounts. Reach out with a DM or email. We'd love to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter by searching the Star Lores podcast. Go ahead and give our page a like and send us a message. You can also email at starlorespodcast@gmail.com. Send us your fan art, Star Wars collections, or fan fictions, and you may even get a feature on one of our pages or even the show. Don't be afraid to offer corrections or add to any of the topics that we discuss on the show. We are also on Patreon, so if you want to help us pay the bills, as well as get a few awesome perks like bonus episodes, access to the private Facebook group, or the VIP section of the Discord server, head on over to patreon.com/StarLores and sign up for as little as $1 a month. And finally, make sure to subscribe to us on your favorite podcatcher app or YouTube, as well as sending us a 5-star review on iTunes. This really helps us reach a wider audience. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Welcome aboard the Millennial Falcon. We're on the Perlemian trade route, just passed by Belgoth's beacon there with that beautiful Kalumai face on it. And can't really see the other two sides of it. There are two other species, though. I don't know. I forget what they are. They're not important to us right now because we're talking about... I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens.
Ancient aliens.
Ancient aliens from a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. So the biggest thing here is, I think, the similarity between Star Wars and a lot of like epic space opera type properties have this idea of ancient aliens.
You just can't say that with a straight face anymore.
I guess also the show Ancient Aliens. We should throw in there in terms of science fiction properties and relying on the ancient aliens trope.
Chariots of the Gods, you know.
Yeah. And then to wit, of course, tied up with all that ancient alien mythology is the pyramids and, you know, Stargates being inside pyramids. I think there's one Ancient Aliens episode that gets into the theory that there's a Stargate beneath Baghdad, I think, is one of the various theories. And of course, there are at least two different kinds of Stargate in the Star Wars universe. Both the Kwa and the Gree sort of invented their own versions of it.
Stargate tech, yeah.
The Kwa's was much more directly, like just looked like the Stargate from the Stargate show.
Franchise.
Except for the sort of the medium, I guess you'd say that they travel through is a little bit different. In Stargate, it's like shimmering sort of silver liquid suspended in that ring. And then I think the Quads is like a really light shade of blue, which is just sort of the vague like magic energy color in Star Wars, I find.
Sometimes it's green.
Fair enough. Or yellow in your eyes. So first thing, why don't we talk about the Kalumai, since they're an obvious sort of nod to Terran, ancient...
gray aliens.
Xenoarchaeology. The gray aliens idea.
Little green men.
Precisely.
Yeah.
The grays, yeah.
So they've got those big heads. And then there's also this theory within Terran UFO mythology about... the reason that the Greys are coming to Earth to abduct us and, you know, extract sperm and eggs and probe and stuff is because they're actually super evolved humans from millions of years in the future who've lost the ability to reproduce. And so they're time traveling back to this point in their genetic history to before they went down this road of turning into skinny little guys with huge heads. And I shouldn't even say guys because they're pretty sexually ambiguous.
Yeah. And that's literally what they call my teeth, right? They have to clone themselves because they can't
reproduce. They're so weak
physically that
they have to have a wheelchair. Although, on the other hand, they're not that weak because they can clearly achieve everything they needed to achieve with their brain power.
Right.
And I actually wanted to point out a cool similarity. I liked how all of the evolutionary history that went into the Kalumai, I haven't really seen it spelled out in any species like that before in the Star Wars universe, where they sort of talk about its ancestral forms at various stages.
There are some that are really cool that they do delve into, but yeah, the Kalumai are very detailed.
Yeah,
sure.
And so that was cool learning about them how they're reptosapiens, right? So they're not, at least they're being a little bit original there and not just making them mammals like us that were apes and that went on and on.
You would have to think, though, at some point in their sort of evolutionary history, they would have had to have like hardcore manual labor up to a point until, you know, they could automate everything and then
start.
Yeah. That would be the point where perhaps they would start weakening physically. So you could just hypothetically think they would have had to been like an automated society for like a very, very long time in order to become that physically weak. Just thinking like,
no, you are right. I also wanted to point out the similarity in the evolutionary track of the Kalumai and what is proposed to be our own evolutionary history that has to do with the encephalization quotient, that ratio of brain mass to body mass. And that's sort of very much in line with humans. And even the size of our heads causes a lot of problems with childbirth.
Natural birth, yeah.
Especially the fact that we're not on all fours, right? The fact that we went bipedal also, it sort of put this extra evolutionary pressure on us to where we had to have kids earlier in the gestation period than normal. So our children were very helpless, like a Kalumai kind of, right? And this was all sort of in service of getting those big brains that can solve these other problems that you normally have to be big and buff to solve. And
so it, does that mean we're going the way of the Kalumai?
I think we are.
Except instead of vestigial limbs, we're going to just grow larger because of our sedentary lifestyles and crappy diets.
Another proposed evolutionary adaptation to the world we've created for ourselves is actually, I'm looking at you two guys, nearsightedness.
Yeah.
Because obviously we do a whole lot of reading. That's a very sort of unnatural behavior.
Yeah. Lots of things close to our faces, whereas like in the wild, you'd be looking out over larger distances, longer distances more often.
Yeah.
Most of your day would be spent, you know, hunting and being outside.
And then I've even heard it also proposed that like, especially in the tech world, sort of Aspergian symptoms are sort of selected for in that world, right? Like being able to not shower for 16 hours and just stare at code all day long is like highly rewarded in that field, right? If you can just...
We'll see when the genetics don't get passed on, how rewarding that is, but yes. Also, let's talk about Grailian technology too, because they also talk a lot about saucers, and that's obviously goes hand in hand with the little green men.
Sorry, where do you know where they first appear, like in Star Wars literature?
No, I actually don't. They're like fairly obscure.
I'd be curious to know who like conceptualized them. And
yeah, and like was it something from like the deep Marvel 80s, or is it like I think something newer?
It does seem like it would almost be like a Marvel thing to do.
Yeah, it's hard to say.
Also, one thing too about evolving with technology, interesting with humanity today, right? Like we're starting to implant things in our bodies and kind of there's cool ideas to be explored there where technology plays a role in how we develop in the future.
Yeah, so. For sure. My sort of pet theory about this is that humans started the... our eventual fusion with machines, like the moment we picked up a rock and started using that as a tool. Because everything after that, right, has just been us getting better at tools and using tools.
Yeah, and then it gets
to modify our environment and ourselves, right?
And it gets to the point where like you're actually implanting things in your body, right? Which is the next stage here that's being explored. Is
I mean, it's not the next stage. People are doing it all the time.
Sure. We've got
cochlear implants and
pacemakers and
insulin pumps that you can put in. And there's even like spinal stimulators now for chronic pain patients where you can just press a button and it just directly stimulates your spinal cord and makes your pain go away.
Yeah, I think what Christian's like referring though to is less out of necessity and more out of like people chopping off their limbs
on purpose to replace.
that transhuman
transhumanism, right. Basically, yeah.
And interestingly, we don't really see much of that sentiment with the Kalumai.
Yeah, it's actually, and it's even reversed in just the Star Wars expanded lore with like how people view, you know, fusion technology with people, which we discussed in the cyborg episode, right? Where it's actually kind of disgusted and like looked down on.
People are prejudiced against that.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Vader is a transhuman and he's hated. Seen as an evil character.
He's unfairly maligned.
Rebel propaganda. Yeah, but it's not the world of cyberpunk, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So some other random bits about the Kessel Run. Talked about the Kessel Run a little bit in our drugs episode, but it's always fun to talk about that infamous line. So I'll just
keep coming back to it.
So I'll just read a little bit of further data from Wikipedia. In the revised fourth draft of A New Hope in 1976, the description for Kessel Run is put as follows. It's the ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. And then Ben reacts to Solo's stupid attempt to impress them with obvious misinformation. That's from the novelization. And so I find that funny that
even back then they were correcting for
yes, they're correcting themselves. And a misinformation has been around for a long time. Do you think he was posting that on a Holo Facebook?
Holo Twitter?
Yeah. Holo Twitter.
That Star Wars is surprisingly lacking in social media.
Oh, we're gonna get into it in our holograms episode. Just you wait. So it implies that the puzzling speech of Han Solo is misinformation and not truth. and it has nothing to do with the nature of the Kessel Run in any respect. Han means nothing other than impressing Obi-Wan and Luke with pure boasting. Indeed, even in the final version of the script, the parentheses attached to Han's line state that he is, quote, obviously lying. I did not read that quite as a lie, but I suppose it could be. It seemed like a boast.
Yeah.
And boasting can obviously often be exaggerations. But until I read this, I never really considered that Han is just making that up.
Which obviously speaks to his character, right? Yeah. Like, untruthful smuggler. But then they did go back and then they made it a thing, right? Because they made it like a time vector situation. It's something that didn't actually have to be corrected, which is interesting because it was fine as is.
Yeah,
in the script, it was maybe like in the original script.
So in the episode 4 DVD, George Lucas mentioned that the parsecs are due to the Millennium Falcon's advanced navigational computer rather than its engines. So the navicomputer would calculate much faster routes than other ships could.
And then in the Solo movie, they have a whole other like time dilation effect. So everyone's trying to explain away something that didn't need to be explained because it was obviously a joke.
or
not obviously. Yeah.
All right, and then jumping back to our realm of Mortis, whether that's inside the monolith or some unidentified planet, which I didn't really realize it until this because I've seen the episode, but that it's
an episode in the Clone Wars series for anyone catching up. But yeah,
but it's interesting that the place they go to when they fly inside of the monolith might not be there, and like we don't even know if it's, you know, Hypergate technology or an Infinity Gate technology, or if it's like something from D&D and they're in some sort of
a
pocket
bag of
universe. Yeah, they're in a gigantic bag of holding. So I just thought that was a cool random little mystery that's never been fleshed out in quite the same way as the parsecs. But also in that realm, there's a tower that's based on Orthanc from Lord of the Rings and was made to resemble the staff of the evil wizard Saruman the White. Location's concept also drew inspiration from Ralph McQuarrie's sketch of Emperor Palpatine's Imperial Palace. So maybe indicating that Palpatine took some inspiration from Lord of the
Saruman,
Rings.
Saruman, maybe?
Or I guess more directly and in-universe from the Celestials, is that he was talking about that. Although you don't really see much interaction between like Celestial material and the Galactic Empire. It's more mostly a older type of story. So the other species, the other old ones, we skip the Kwa. I think they might deserve an episode of their
own. They reappear more prominently in like the future too. So.
And we've talked about them on the podcast as well.
Yeah.
So. But they're cool. Blue dinosaurs. There's a great episode of The Outer Limits, which is like an old 90s sci-fi Canadian show where they have these aliens, and actually these aliens are using teleportation technology as well. But they're like just sentient raptors.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was like
interesting.
A very cool idea.
The Outer Limits is sort of like, it was sort of like an evolution of the Twilight Zone, but a precursor to Black Mirror almost.
Yeah. It was very much that.
Like, it was kind of an interesting show, but
they like, Black Mirror is more just about the dark side of technology. And it's more focused than it's science fiction.
Yeah.
Outer Limits dabbled in like every sort of subgenre of science fiction, but the dark technology definitely came up quite a bit.
Yeah.
So our other species, the Gree, they're like our Lovecraftian aliens. Yeah. They're all tentacular.
More sinister.
And ancient. And they have like all these weird offshoots of like their culture because they're so old, they can look back millions of years and like sort of look at their ancient past with the same degree of wonder that sort of we look at their ancient past, like it's almost something completely different,
separate.
And then they sort of deify that ancient version of themselves and like worship it and do all sorts of foul rituals. They like sacrifice Killix to Abeloth and all that kind of stuff, which is not what you'd expect a super advanced alien species to
do.
Be like religious zealots, right?
Another just fun fact about the Gree too. Commander Gree, a clone trooper, is named after the Gree species, particularly because of their mentality and demeanor. And so
they popped up a couple times in the Clone Wars, didn't they? I swear there's at least one actual Gree.
I have to somewhere watch. It's not beyond Filoni to drop that kind of deep lore into it either. So entirely possible.
And then we've got our Celestials. Yeah. They're pretty malleable in their form. I don't know. Maybe they're just made out of midichlorians or something.
Yeah, they're never discussed as like how they exist as a biological species. They're very like, they like to play with the god complex idea of like aliens so advanced that they're...
And they certainly, in the Clone Wars episode, appear humanoid, even human, I think.
Yeah.
But then they can also like just change shape into something totally different at will.
Like so a bat. Like,
so what was the humanoid form, their original form?
Yeah. Is it something that someone who observes them kind of automatically kind of imposes their own, right? If a different alien looked at them, maybe they'd see them as their own race. Just because we see them through the eyes of humans. So there's a lot around them that we don't know as a species. We see a lot of their artifacts left behind. That's kind of what they're known for and like shaping the galaxy. And it's a common trope in like sci-fi. You know, you have everything from like the Forerunners and Precursors in Halo. You know, Warhammer 40K has its own bunch of like Necron, Eldar, Old Ones.
The Reapers in Mass Effect.
Yeah, it's a very common trope in science fiction to have this like almost godlike species that is able to craft these like world-ending technologies and just leave behind all these artifacts that are, you know, almost magical by lesser species.
In Disney Wars, the Celestials were beings known for their singing.
Wow, what an upgrade.
And that's about it. And Lando Calrissian talks about them.
They have to include the Celestials, though, because they appear in the Clone Wars.
I like how in Disney Wars, the Dianaga is gender fluid. That's, to me...
There's a whole thing about Dianaga.
I actually think that is a slight upgrade, because they turned them sentient and partially Force-sensitive, which I thought was interesting, to make these sewer creatures like a real person, basically.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to Star Wars. So just jumping back to Earth archaeology again, and I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens. the Mortis monolith and the Thoyor have that sort of double pyramid shape, right, where it's like a diamond. Yeah. And there's also some alternative archaeologists who believe that the Great Pyramid of Giza is like that.
There's actually
another pyramid that goes directly beneath it. I don't know if that was on purpose.
I think it was a nod to ancient aliens.
If they actually knew, or if it just seemed like that would look like a better spaceship than
just
two pyramids.
And fun, just a quick thing on the Thoyor. We don't know for sure that it was the Celestials that built them. It's never like absolutely stated, but it's cool how they tie it in with the way that the pyramidal structures look between the
Mortis monolith
and the Thoyor themselves.
Also, Sith holocrons are also generally that shape.
Pyramidal, yeah.
There are some exceptions, but they're
typically
also,
yeah,
typically pyramids. Sometimes I think they're even the stacked pyramid kind.
Maybe there's something in the dark side that channels through pyramid shapes.
Well, there's also all the mythology around pyramids having magic powers.
And like energy vectors. Yeah.
And like if you put like a razor blade underneath a pyramid, like it'll never dull or something.
Because it's science.
If you never use it.
And then, of course, Aleister Crowley, who I think we brought up on our Devil Worlds review, famously, he was like an old-timey occultist from the dawn of the 20th century. He famously went inside the Great Pyramid of Giza and got up to some adult nonsense. Possibly heralded World War II and the garbage fire that is Earth in 2021. But you never know.
Unconfirmed.
That would be interesting for sure.
And then, of course, Revan Sith are very Nazi-like in, you know, all the obvious ways in terms of genocide and being an expansionist empire and elitists and that kind of thing. But they're also very Nazi-like in that Nazis loved archaeology. And you might think that's like a joke. Like I'm referencing Indiana Jones.
No, but they drew Indiana Jones. But it's actually true. It was from real life, yeah.
There were a bunch of Nazis running around South America and Africa and stuff looking for the Spear of Destiny and and all kinds of wacky things like that, looking for Ultima Thule.
Was that just for the knowledge, or did they believe it had some kind of magical property to it?
That's hard to say.
Column A, column B.
From my reading of sort of Nazi history, it seems like the guys who are into the occult stuff, they got into it early. Like they got into the Nazi party sort of on the ground floor. So then by the time World War II was underway, they were like
at fairly high up.
At the highest position, but they were all sort of fairly ridiculous buffoon types of characters. And like a lot of their subordinates didn't really respect them and thought they were crazy. They were just doing what they were being told. And then actually Germany has a very old history with anthropology and archaeology. They basically like started those fields and did a lot of the foundational work in it in, again, that sort of early 20th century period. Like some of the most famous archaeologists who, if you take an intro to archaeology class, you'll study like Flinders, Petrie, and people like that were German archaeologists. Klaus Kinski, I think, is another one. He's a modern one. And they continue that tradition to today. You go to any archaeological site, almost anywhere in the world, you'll find a bunch of German nationals looking at it. For some reason. For some reason.
Inexplicable reason.
I think they're looking for the Holy Grail.
Still.
That's just me. Yeah. So what's your favorite Star Wars artifact?
I'd have to say the Star Forge. I like the Star Forge because it's not a Death Star.
I agree with it. It is a super weapon, but it takes a different. It's
more interesting than it can blow up a star. It can blow up a planet. It can.
It also, the Starforge feels to me in a way much more sinister than the Death Star, because the Death Star feels just like so mass produced and just kind of like faceless. It is sort of evil and embodies like the bad part of industrialization and mechanization and stuff. But the Starforge feels like it's almost like haunted by the spirits of the dark Rakatans who used it and couldn't control their power. Yeah. It's corrupting Malak and Revan.
And it uses creation as a means of control rather than destruction.
Exactly.
But it's also sort of shadowy too, right? Because you don't know where this army is coming from and out of nowhere. So it can kind of like hide in the corners of the galaxy and no one can find it. And no one would ever know how, you know, one person is amassing this
massive fleet.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's something sort of, that's like another element that makes it interesting, you know, that you can do some interesting stuff with in terms of storylines. But I think my favorite super weapon is still probably the Sun Crusher.
That's not an artifact. Yeah.
No, it's got to be an artifact.
Sun Crusher is pretty great though. Never has an ice cream cone been so scary. That's what the Sun Crusher looks like.
So,
your favorite artifact, Sam?
I think the double-bladed lightsaber. I like how there's sort of a reconstruction you can do, almost like you would do in actual archaeology if you're like trying to figure out when a Roman cestus or something was first used.
Yeah,
and trying to like find
trace it back
chronology through the holocrons and looking at the Great Sith Wars. So that's cool. But just to finish, I would also like to make the case that KOTOR 1 and to a lesser extent KOTOR 2 are essentially games about archaeology. You're basically an archaeologist, especially in KOTOR 1.
Going to old ruins, investigating.
Every single planet you go to, except for Taris. But even Taris has an archaeological part because you go to the underworld and that's an ancient... Yeah. Or the Undercity, which is ancient.
Yeah.
And then you're looking for the star maps the rest of the game. So you're
And then
doing
the very obvious Sith Academy, which is like a whole segment on archaeology.
And I was going to bring that up. I would love to hear like an archaeologist sort of break down the Sith dig site on Korriban in KOTOR 1 and rate them on how well they're doing.
And you know what they'll say? I'm not saying it's aliens.
I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens. All right. You guys got anything else?
No.
I'm all dug out.
All right. May the forks be with you.